thank you very much for everyone. We'll get started. So I'm Professor Hyun-Won Shin, the Director of Associate of Southeast Asia Center and also Professor in the Department of Geography and Environment. It's a great pleasure to open this Southeast Asia Discussion Series seminar that we at the center are organizing. So this will be the first one that we are having in this academic year, and it's a great pleasure to have our two experts. So we have a speaker, Dr. Paul Rabe, who is from the Netherlands. So Paul is the head of cities cluster at the Institute, International Institute for Asian Studies in Leiden in the Netherlands, where he's also coordinating two very interesting and important networks. One is called Urban Knowledge Asia Network, and the other Southeast Asia Neighborhood Network, abbreviated as CNET. And he is also a senior land expert at the International Institute for Housing and Urban Development at Erasmus University of Rotterdam, where he's been working on the issues of land sharing, and especially the idea of land sharing as a land conflict resolution tool in countries like Thailand and Cambodia, which is basically the main topic that he's going to share with us today. So we also have another expert, Dr. Anna Kant, who is sitting over there, who is assistant professor in history in the Department of International History here at the LSE. She is not working on Southeast Asia, but she is a Latin American historian looking at 20th century politics, culture, history, and also rural development as well, especially looking at Karoo. So she's working at the moment on a book monograph, which is entitled Land Without Masters, the relationship between agrarian reform and political change in Karoo between 1968 and 1975, based on her thesis, PhD from University of Cambridge. So we thought it'd be very nice to actually have this cross-regional dialogue so that we don't really necessarily have to just look at Southeast Asia, but also how Southeast Asia, the kind of the topics such as land can also be discussed from the perspective of Latin America or another region. I think this is one of the things that SEAC, Southeast Asia Center at LSE, is trying to promote, so that we examine various urban various kind of political, social, economic issues that concern Southeast Asia, but placing Southeast Asia not in isolation, but in conversation with other regions. So this is kind of format that we have, and trying to pursue this format as much as possible, based on the availability, of course, of experts. But today we are fortunate to have one Southeast Asian expert, but Paul nevertheless also works on Africa as well. So he himself has been doing this comparative studies on both Africa and Southeast Asia. So we have these two expert contributions. Paul will be speaking for about 40 minutes.
Up to you.
Yeah, 40 minutes.
I think you have to stop me as well. I'd love to go on.
So 40 minutes, let's say, and Anna will discuss for up to 10 minutes, and then we have plenty of time to have debate with everyone in the room involved. So without further ado, please, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this invitation. This invitation to come speak today, and thanks for the great format, which I agree is really this cross-regional format, which works really well for an issue like land. And thanks, Lee, for all the arrangements, and Anna for being the discussant today. It's an honor for me to be here, and take part in your discussion series, Southeast Asian discussion series, on a topic that's particularly close to my heart. So as I said, I can talk about this for a long time, so you really have to, I will take a look at the clock to make sure I don't go over time too much. But land sharing is something which I have looked at for a long time. Let's see, how do I advance the slides?
Sorry?
There's a PDF. Oh, you're using the PDF. Okay.
Oh, no, for that slide I was, but this is on the PowerPoint.
Okay.
So, yeah, I've been looking at land sharing for quite a while, and I was first attracted to it because it's kind of a unique tool. It's a tool that I look at both from a technical point of view, but very important is to point out that it's at the end, land is of course very political, and we cannot avoid the political aspects of access to land. So my interest in land sharing was provoked many years ago by this very simple question: as cities expand, is there room for the urban poor? It's a question that is not just relevant for Southeast Asia, it's a question relevant to all our cities, including here in Europe. But I would argue there are certain factors in Southeast Asia which make this question even more relevant, which is that urbanization in Southeast Asia is very much private sector pushed and dominated, I would argue, compared to other regions of the world. That makes it very dynamic. It also makes the question of where do the urban poor and other marginalized group fit in, I think, makes that question very relevant. So that is, I would argue, something that is Southeast Asia specific, but I'd be interested to hear from Anna if in Latin America there's some aspect of that as well. So this is the underlying question for me. What I'm going to do is address the following topics. If we have time, I'll go through it a bit quickly in the interest of time, but I hope in the discussion afterwards we can go into a bit more detail later. So the tool, the land sharing tool, was pioneered in Bangkok. I'll explain that, in the 1970s and 80s, by housing activists, very much informally. It became formalized later in the Royal Thai government's, as part of the government's housing scheme, which is very interesting. In Cambodia, it's a very different process, land sharing, and I'll explain the difference. And then topic number five, I'd like to look at what's going on now. In fact, I just came back from Cambodia and Thailand last week, so I had an opportunity to look at some of these sites that I'll be sharing with you, and to look at what's going on now. And I think what's going on now in both countries, but especially Thailand, is also very interesting now. And then I'd like to conclude with some kind of see if we can make some kind of evaluation of land sharing now, and what does that mean to bring it back more to the housing policy discussion. So let's look at first, what is land sharing? Perhaps very simply, so you can see the diagram on the left is a kind of a simplification of a situation that that we know how informal settlements look like. Irregular sized settlements spread out over a parcel of land, often no or not much infrastructure, and the question of slums or informal settlements, I'm not going to spend too much time on discussing this, but land sharing can take place both with settlements that are formalized and settlements that are informal. So there's a range of different legal situations here. But the point is there's always a conflict. And that conflict makes that we need a tool to resolve that conflict for both sides. The land occupants, the ones on this, in the blocks on the diagram, and the owner of the land, which is either a private sector owner or a public agency. So, you could see the diagram on the right, which is the stylized or simple version of sort of the end product. The sharing, the plot is shared by the landowner and by these occupants, the land occupants. And as part of this land sharing process, the land occupants are fully regularized in their legal situation and in their housing situation. So we end up from a situation on the left with irregular kind of development to a situation on the right with some kind of sharing and formalization of the land claim. So that's the, in a nutshell, what land sharing does. So there's two core characteristics of land sharing. There's a physical characteristic. So as part of this process, housing is regularized, formalized, and the land occupants get services, whereas in before they often didn't have formal services, water, sanitation, etc. And they get, of course, new housing in better conditions. And the most important characteristic, perhaps, of land sharing is that it's on site. And that is the whole point. We have many examples from all over the world where affordable housing is provided either through social housing or other schemes, but that housing is far away from the center. And the urban poor are relegated further and further away from the city centers. And this is not a solution because it invites further squatting because they just want to come back to where the jobs are. So land sharing offers a solution which is on site, and that's perhaps the biggest attraction of this tool. There's also a legal dimension which is very important. So as I said before, as part of this process, the land occupants get legal status. So they are allowed to stay formally on their share of the land, their corner of the land, as we could say. And that right to stay is accepted by the authorities because the authorities are involved somehow in this whole process. So I often refer to it as a win-win-win tool. There are winners in theory, and we'll look at why that often doesn't happen in practice, but there are winners in theory at three levels. There's the landowners and the private developers. For them, a land conflict means that they cannot develop, and so development is blocked because of the conflict. And often, in many cases, certainly in Cambodia and before that in Thailand, the private landowners tried every trick in the book to get the land occupants off the land, either by starting a fire, kicking them out, the bulldozer. Many other methods are used, but the land occupants come back and just start again to rebuild their housing. So solution to the problem is not easy to find. So for them, the benefit of land sharing is they can develop. The benefit for the informal settlers is obviously the new housing and the new legal status, and it's on site, so it's in the city. And finally, the public authorities also have a big win, which is a long simmering land conflict is not in their interest either. Often these plots of land are in the city center, and this is not attractive for the city, and the conflict is obviously not an optimal political situation. So the win-win-win aspect is very important here. So I often joke that, because I've also worked in the Palestinian territories, if we could just do land sharing in different parts of the world, why can't we just share? If it were so easy, then obviously this would be done on a larger scale. But the principle is easy, but it's the political dimensions which makes it very hard, and why you don't see it in many other parts of the world. So I'd be interested in the discussion to find out perhaps why. So in the research that I have done and other colleagues, including Kyu Sheng Yap, we have come to the conclusion that there are six conditions which make for successful land sharing. Without these six conditions, you wouldn't have land sharing in the first place, or it wouldn't be successful. The first is that you need a booming property market. It's that booming market that makes that both parties, the land owners and the land occupants, want to come to some kind of a deal. If the land market is not booming, then there's not so much incentive to come to this deal. The second point is communities need to be well established. This comes to the power dimensions, the political dimensions. If a community is not well established in the sense of hasn't been there for a very long time or doesn't have some kind of a land right, then it's fairly easy for the authorities or for the private landowner to kick them off the land. The third point is, besides being well established, the community also needs to be organized and have some kind of consensus which makes them strong in the negotiation. The fourth point is, and this is, was problematic in the Cambodian case, you need third-party intermediation. So who's going to be the intermediary in this negotiation, and often it's a long negotiation, between the land occupants and the land owner? Is that intermediary going to be a government agency? Is it an NGO? Or are there other players? Fifth point, the physical and technical feasibility. As we'll see in one of the Cambodian cases that I'll present, a land site, a land parcel needs to be physically conducive to share, so that there's enough room for the commercial development and for the land occupants to be rehoused. That's not often the case. And then the last point, but certainly not least, what is the financial model for the land sharing deal? There needs to be a feasible model that doesn't cost too much relative to the alternatives. And who's going to pay up? And as we'll see, there are different models in both countries and in other situations. So our conclusion is, if not all of these six preconditions are met, then we probably won't get land sharing, which I think goes a long way to explaining why we don't see more land sharing in the world. Arguably, there are cultural characteristics. I've spoken to many Thai housing activists who say that in our culture, we have a culture of prani pranom, where we have an ability to, how would you translate in English, flexibility to in a kind of negotiation. That's very culturally specific, they say. And it's, you don't see that in many other countries where both parties are willing to negotiate and to give concessions. It was more difficult in Cambodia, for instance. So the case studies that I'm going to talk about in Thailand began in 1977, and they lasted for about 2 decades. These are what we call the original land sharing sites. In the meantime, we have land sharing in the more established government programs, and these are later. In Phnom Penh, the ones that I was also working on, because maybe I should explain my interest is not just as a researcher. I was also working for the UN at the municipality of Phnom Penh in this period to try to make land sharing happen. And for better or for worse, this did not always happen. And I'll try to explain also why I think it was problematic. So it took place about 10 years ago. Let's look at the Generation 1 in Bangkok, which was the pioneering projects. So what was interesting in this period is that you had the military government actively in the saddle, and a lot more slums than are in Bangkok today. A lot of also smaller slums in the sort of spaces, in the empty spaces of the city. This is not a long discussion, but it is characteristic of the land settlement model in Bangkok, which is that many private landowners actually let people settle informally on their land, and they would collect rent. And the agreement was, when the land becomes very valuable, then you have to leave. But in the meantime, you can stay. So this was kind of a land rental model, which was very flexible in Thailand always. That broke down when the land market became very hot. So the conflicts were started to happen when a lot of these communities said, well, we paid rent, so we have some kind of a right now to stay. So they broke, in a way, this kind of informal agreement that was at the basis of the land rental idea. And they went to powerful people to back them, military generals, housing activists, and maybe some of you know Khun Somsuk Bunya Bancha, who is now retired but has been one of the main housing activists, I would say, in the world. And at that time, she was at the National Housing Authority. And she and a couple of other people, in their individual capacity, started to defend these people and say, listen, there is no reason why we should continue this practice of keep kicking these people off their land if they have been in the city for decades. So we need to support these people to be able to share the land and be able to settle in the city center. So out of this model of intermediation came seven projects, and I kind of illustrate here just three examples of land sharing. The biggest was in this port area here, in the Klong, this is Klong Toei, which was the biggest slum always in Bangkok until quite recently. And you see that before land sharing, the picture on the right shows the port area. This is wetland marsh, squatted, a huge area squatted by informal settlers. After land sharing, the situation looked like this, where actually the informal settlers got regularized in quite a big area of the port area, and the port was relegated to this bottom portion. And this was low-rise housing, which is quite quite remarkable. The two other smaller cases are, you can see on the left, that is Manakasila, and the other one is Samyod project. But you can see the kind of the sharing, what the sharing looked like on a map after the projects. I'm not going to go through this table, but for those of you who are interested, this is a summary of the seven original land sharing cases in Bangkok. I think the main point is most of them were on public land, and this shows you one of the difficulties of land sharing. It works better on public land than on private land. It's more difficult to get private landowners on board for this than public landowners. And the main public landowner was the Crown Property Bureau in Thailand, which is a major landowner. Now this is also changing, and I'll get to that a little bit later. The Treasury Department was another landowner, and there we have also the I think King's Property Bureau there as some of the landowners, other public landowners. I think there was only one in that original period that was a private landowner. So that as a brief background, and the focus of my presentation will be actually in Phnom Penh in Cambodia. I don't think I have to explain to this audience where Cambodia is, so I'm going to skip the map. Compared to Bangkok, Phnom Penh is a much smaller city, about perhaps 10 times smaller. But because of the upheaval that the country had been through with the civil war and the Khmer Rouge period, there was a legacy of informality, which is much more difficult to grasp, to tackle. In May 2003, so what happened after 1979, after the Khmer Rouge period, is that everyone came en masse back to the city. Most people had been forced out of the city, especially the intellectuals and anyone with money and with academic background. People came back en masse to the city, and in a way, everyone was then a squatter. So the whole population were squatters. And everyone just settled where they could. And then came along a process over decades of people fighting for land, the weaker losing out, the stronger gaining access to the best land in the best parts of the city, and using their connections to get formal title to the land. And so you saw eviction after eviction of poor people, often outside to the city, literally in the beginning just dumped by trucks to the outskirts of the city with maybe just a bag of rice. So obviously they would come right back. So this whole system would go on for decades. And then in 2003, after a lot of advocacy by pro-poor groups, Asian Coalition for Housing Rights, UPDF, etc., who had lobbied the government and says, you cannot go on like this, just kicking thousands and thousands of households out of the city with nothing. You have to have a program. So then came this breakthrough where the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Hun Sen, who is still the Prime Minister after 30 years, he announced a slum upgrading campaign for over 500 settlements at that time in the city, some very small, some bigger. And this was quite a revolution. So the government, for the first time, agreed that we're going to upgrade on-site, and that was also remarkable, many of these settlements with full services and land titles. It was a complete revolution compared to what had been gone on before for decades. And housing rights organizations declared an era, a newfound power and citizenship for the poor. A whole new era had been born. And there were four land sharing pilot sites which were announced, and these were the four that then I worked on with the municipality to get them to be realized. And these are the four projects. The biggest is Boregela, which translates as the sports buildings. These were, I'll show you on the map later, but that was a former athlete's village, which was built for the 1966, I believe, Southeast Asian Games. After the war, after people came back, they just squatted all over this athlete's village. And we're talking about almost 1,800 families. The second project, De Graham, or Red Earth, was located on the what is now very lucrative Bassac riverfront area of the city. Smaller project. And then there's two railway projects along the railway line coming into Phnom Penh. People have settled along the railways. These four areas were declared as land sharing sites where the government agreed these people could stay and they would be upgraded. And the financial model was different here than in Thailand. So in the Thai cases, I should have mentioned, the financial model was urban poor households get who participate in the scheme, they get small loans from the government for housing materials to build often their own house. And they pay back years later, so it was kind of a subsidy from the low interest loans from the government. In Cambodian situation, the government didn't have money to do this, so they came up with a cross subsidy scheme from real estate development. So they would invite real estate developers to come in and develop on the site, and the commercial development would help finance the housing for the urban poor. So very different financial model between the two countries. Now, in my research, I've been interested in these two levels of analysis, the technical and the political. Land sharing, on the one hand, is a technical instrument of slum redevelopment. On the political level, using the language of these housing rights organizations, it's an era of enfranchisement, and for the first time, these people became citizens. So in the Cambodian discourse, the urban poor were called anarchists because they would settle anywhere and they would live in unplanned communities. And the interesting thing is that in my research I found that the people themselves described themselves as anarchists as well. So they kind of internalized this language of power and called themselves anarchists and therefore not citizens. But these schemes were supposed to bring an end to all of this, and then through these schemes they would become citizens living in planned areas, and they would get They would regain power. So I won't go in detail about this. And so I was seeing whether this would indeed work through land sharing. So the two questions I asked were, as a result of land sharing in their settlements, did the slum residents obtain access to the promised tenure security and the urban services on the site at the one level? This is an easier form of citizenship, we can say. The citizenship as practice is more difficult. Did these slum residents mobilize and organize themselves to shape the design and outcome of these land sharing schemes? So I tried to answer both questions. This was, by the way, in my research, not in my work for the UN. Historical context, I'm also not going to go into too much detail about this unless there are questions later. But perhaps the most interesting thing was the land law 2001. So after decades of almost lawlessness and legal ambiguity as to who is a legitimate landowner and who is not, the government passed a law in 2001 declaring a cutoff date. If you as a resident had been living anywhere before August 2001 and you had been living there without displacing someone else and you had been living there peacefully, you could claim the right to settle on that land. That was the cutoff date. If you arrived afterwards, then you were not a claimant unless you had bought the land from someone and did the titling process. So that was a cutoff date, and it's very important for this discussion because all of these residents in this settlement, these four settlements that I'm talking about, met the requirement of living there before August 2001. So they were not squatters. They were not anarchists. They were legal, according to the land law 2001, legal occupants. But they were never treated as such by the government. So this is an aerial photograph from 2005. So this is like a long time ago in Phnom Penh history, because a lot has changed in the meantime. But here you can see the location of the four sites. Boregala, the biggest project, is right here in the city center. This is a lake. You can see the lake in the middle of the picture. Sorry, it's a long way to walk towards that way. But there's a lake just above the three dots that you can see. That lake is no longer there. The government has filled in the lake. It's part of a massive exercise to win more land for basically commercial development. That whole lake is gone. The railway sites are just below the lake, and the Boregala settlement is also in that area. The fourth project, the Red Earth Project, Dagor Home, is on the Basak Riverfront, which is right here. It's where the Phnom Penh is, where the Tonle Sap River and the Mekong come together. And this riverfront area has become very hot in terms of real estate. Right now, you see this in this photograph, you see this island as pretty much green, undeveloped. Right now, it's the most booming part of town. And massive amounts of money are going in there to develop this area. So, and one of the land sharing sites was located right there in this riverfront at a time when the real estate values started to increase rapidly. So let's look briefly at these four cases. So Boregala settlement, about 1,800 families, a prime location in the middle of the city. This is on the Athletes Village site. The land sharing scheme here was that a Cambodian developer was invited to redevelop the site with on one, in this corner of the site you see here already, the first three buildings being built to rehouse the residents. All the shacks around there would be cleared and the residents moved into these apartments. That was the idea. And the developer would build 10 buildings to rehouse these residents. And to be financed through cross subsidies by the private developer. It was a very innovative scheme, and to this day, it's the only land sharing scheme which actually, well, worked. This is a discussion, and some of you in the audience, Giorgio, you know the difficulties here. The question I will ask at the end of the presentation is, did this land sharing scheme really work for the benefit of the residents and for the city? That's an interesting question to answer. Because there were a lot of problems here. But let me go to the other projects first before we come back to this question. So here you can see the pictures, the 10 buildings that were supposed to be built on this side of the site, and the rest of the site would be developed commercially. Actually, in the beginning, it was just supposed to be the outside of this area, but the developer took the whole area. The second project on the this is an illustration of the physical illustration of the transformation from shacks and the old Athletes Village apartments to these brand new buildings where the services would be there, the water, the sanitation, the power. For the first time in their lives, these residents would have these kinds of services. The second project was in this Basak Riverfront area, and you can see here a very it's an L-shaped area on the map, squeezed in between all kinds of other buildings. The shacks here and next to a building which is called the White Building, which is also no longer there. It's been torn down. But a lot of families living squeezed in a very narrow and difficult to settle piece of land. What happened here is that a developer, 5 minutes left, wow.
Sorry, 10 minutes.
Oh, 10 minutes, thank you. There was a developer that agreed to redevelop the site for land sharing, but then the residents would have to live in a 10-story tower. And the residents got together and said, we don't want that. We prefer to do a land swap. So instead of land sharing, we prefer to do a land swap where we as occupants, legally recognized occupants, we will agree to go somewhere else. But in return, we want ground floor townhouse apartments in an area near the Phnom Penh airport, which at that time seemed very far, but the residents were in a way quite that foresight, and they knew that area was going to be developed. So they would rather have a land swap with ground floor apartments, which is this picture here on the right, then being squeezed in a 10-story tower in the city center. So this was another interesting result. It was not a land, so it was a failure of land sharing, but it was a land swap instead. But the land sharing here failed because of these physical characteristics. And the residents decided for themselves. So I was on the bus with these residents when they were bussed out by the developer for the first time to look at their new housing. And they were in awe. You know, we're gonna live in these shop house units, we can build one or two floors above our shop house, we're going to get services. They were quite amazed. Now the third and fourth cases, this was more tragic. These were the railroad cases. The residents here were very well organized, and they refused any kind of deal with the developer that wanted to develop on the site, because they wanted single-story housing. The developer says, this is prime land, you can't get single-story housing. You can get medium story housing, but they refused. And they refused for years and years and years. And what the developer did in the meantime is to buy off the community organizers. So one by one, these people were bought off and for a pittance. So they left and the developer got the whole site. So land sharing here failed, possibly because of intransigence of the community or the inflexibility, I would say. So even housing rights organizations were telling them, you have to compromise a little bit and not insist on the ground floor housing if you want to stay in this area. So in the end, the developer just bought them off for maybe $10,000, people who had lived in the area for decades, which is really a pittance. And they were spread out all over the city. So what are the latest developments now? So I just coming back from Phnom Penh last week. What happened in the Boregala case, the biggest area is that the developer, I showed you that this was the scheme, right? The developer was supposed to build 10 buildings, but instead the developer built only 8. So there were about more than 100, perhaps almost 200 households that didn't get their promised apartments, just because the developer decided either ran out of money or decided they didn't want to build the last buildings. So this is still a festering problem today. These people are partly squatting on the site, hoping that the buildings will still get built, or they have received some kind of payoff and have left the site. So land sharing here it happened for a majority of the community, but not for all, because 2 of these community buildings were not built. So it was a contract that was broken by the developer, but the municipality, as the intermediary, never followed up on its promise and has not held the developer to account. The area today looks like this, and you can see, so this is the Boregala project, lots of commercial development. You can see here the kind of building that is now being built in Phnom Penh, in the Sak Riverfront area, where Singapore is obviously the model. Massive buildings built by Chinese developers, an enormous amount of Chinese money coming in. And you wonder for who is going to live in these buildings. These were the shop houses built by the developer in the Boregala site, very middle class housing. This is what's coming up there now. All Chinese developers. Some of the signs are in Khmer, but there are a lot of sort of real estate signs only in Chinese, which kind of gives you, it's clear who the target audience is here. It's for investors or residents who want to settle there, Chinese, Cambodians, or Chinese from the mainland. So this is what the riverfront looks like now. From a very sleepy, dusty kind of town, Phnom Penh is really becoming an area with a lot of development. This is the new skyline. Lots of casinos. And you don't see it clearly, but I took a picture of one of the signs. It says, embrace the spectacular. And to me, that's kind of a metaphor for what Phnom Penh is now. The city wants to get rid of its reputation as a dusty capital on the Mekong, and it wants to join the ranks of Singapore and Bangkok and all these other places, and it wants to embrace the spectacular. And so the question is there room for affordable housing in this new spectacular vision of the city? Okay, so finally, I'll close with this, that in Thailand, what's happening now is very interesting because land sharing, as I said, is now part of the government's housing schemes, especially the Ban Man Kong secure housing scheme, which is rehousing slum settlements, which is supported by CODI, which is what Som Suk Bunyabancha, the housing activist, founded. This organization is now part of the government. And they see land sharing as one of the tools in their toolkit of how to redevelop these slum settlements. And they do this as part of scaling up. It's a scheme to scale up these housing redevelopment. Instead of individual projects, it's now part of a citywide upgrading project. An interesting thing is that is happening. I mentioned before the Crown Property Bureau in Thailand, which is a big landowner, and a lot of these communities were settled on Crown Property land. The new king has given sort of mixed signals about where he wants to go with the Crown Property Bureau, but it looks like it's going to be a more commercial approach, where the land will, in the past, the Crown Property Bureau would give amnesties to a lot of the communities who had settled there and allow for things like land sharing. But this policy might not be continued in the future. We don't know. There's uncertainty. And if the Crown Property decides that land is valuable commercially, then a lot of this will have big implications for a lot of these communities on Crown Property Bureau land. There are other experiences in Asia with land sharing, and I'd like to maybe in the discussion get to this, and perhaps in other parts of the world. And in the audience, we have Harsh, who's a PhD candidate at DPU, UCL. And maybe after the talk, Harsh, you can say a little bit about, so you're looking at the slum rehabilitation policy in Pune in India, which is also a land sharing, basically a land sharing kind of scheme. So maybe you can talk about this for 1 or 2 minutes after the talk somehow, if we see how we can fit that in. But the point is there are different things going on in other parts of Asia where we can ask, this has elements of land sharing. My analysis, to finalize here, how would I evaluate land sharing in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia? I would say in Thailand, it's well established as a tool, and it's being, after the seven pioneering projects of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we have land sharing now as part of the slum rehabilitation policy of the government. In Cambodia, it's more difficult. The Borah Ekala project that I described, where the last two community buildings were not built, obviously that's a problematic project. On the other hand, one can argue it's a first of its kind. And as institutions mature, as intermediation would mature, hopefully we can get more such projects in the past, learning from this effort. But for sure, we can discuss this project was problematic in many respects. And perhaps the most problematic was the assumption that these people would get free housing for nothing as a gift by the government, whereas they were actually land occupants with a legitimate claim to the land, who shouldn't have just been given something for free and expect to, you know, with gratitude, accept housing in very dubious quality as well. But that's a longer discussion. the two questions that I asked about citizenship, my conclusion is no, these projects have not resulted in citizenship of status, connoting legal empowerment and equal status. In fact, these projects didn't do much to change the attitude that the urban poor don't deserve to be in the city. They can only remain so if the government, from the bottom of its heart, you know, declares that they can do so exceptionally, and they get this gift, these kinds of projects. There's no, these projects did not result in any kind of revolution that we originally thought. So in that sense, not much has changed. On the other hand, I think it is a start. We have to start somewhere. And that as problematic as these projects have been, they have been interesting. And the project where the community agreed to the land swap is also interesting, because there we did see that the community took matters in its own hands and decided we didn't want land sharing there, we wanted something else. And I think that is an interesting precedent as well. Maybe I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much. Perhaps some of the slides can be used for the discussions later on.
Sure. I'd love more up there, but sure.
Before that, we would love to hear from Anna, Anna Khan from Department of International History has discussed. For those of you who arrived in after my introduction, Dr. Anna Khan is from the LSE, Latin American historian, looking at the land issues as well. So we put together the speaker, discussant, who come from different regional background to have a dialogue. So please, Anna.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's always great to engage in comparative discussions. And thank you, Paul, for the excellent paper. So just to explain, my thesis research was on land reform in Peru. Basically in the 1970s, the military government of Juan Velasco Alvarado forcibly expropriated estates and then redistributed them to agricultural cooperatives. And this had a huge political and cultural impact on the country, as well as its obvious economic repercussions. So I guess I should preface what I'm about to say by saying that I focus on rural issues of land rather than the urban context, and I think there are important distinctions there. And you know, I'm obviously coming at it from a historical perspective as well. But nevertheless, I think there are some really important and interesting points of comparison. The first one that really stood out to me was the notion of sharing. This is a recurrent issue in programs of government reform. So what kind of sharing are we talking about? What is the language and imagery used to promote it? Does this sharing continue after the land is divided? And then what's the relationship between the developers and the communities in that shared land? So in the Peruvian case, cooperatives were presented as an ideal form of socioeconomic organisation that would not only produce more productive agricultural estates, but also would result in better economic organisation and would result in better citizens, essentially, because people would think about each other's interests collectively. What Paul has presented today seems like a more pragmatic, less idealistic mode of sharing. But in that case, what are the key ideas that animate this idea as a social model? Another key point of comparison is citizenship. So with the Peruvian agrarian reform, Velasco famously declared that with the land reform, peasants would no longer be second-class citizens, that they would be part of the Peruvian nation, and they would be able to take an active part in politics. But again, the point about the structural impediments to citizenship really stand out and resonate with the Latin American case also. So although the rhetoric of land for those who work it was vital for questioning certain forms of economic and political control by landowning elites, that kind of egalitarian sentiment cannot be embedded without a complete overhaul of government institutions and mechanisms for these new citizens to get involved in politics and have their voice heard. So more recently, Hernando de Soto, the Peruvian economist, has argued that the key is all about titling and formalising land claims, and that this in turn would result in being able to participate in the Peruvian state and improving citizenship. But again, you know, if you've got a land title and nothing else that connects you to the wider polity, then how useful are property rights? Thirdly, an issue that I guess is not really within your scope of study, but really intrigued me, was the idea of memory. So in the Peruvian case, memory of the agrarian reform continues to be extremely divided, and it's used as a political emblem, with people who support what happened arguing for further state reform and more egalitarian politics, more check on the power of big companies, and those who opposed it are arguing that this was really the downfall of the Peruvian state. In the Cambodian case, how do memories of land nationalisation affect levels of public trust in the state? And the whole legitimacy that seems to be implicit in the idea of the municipality or other government bodies as the arbitrator in cases of land sharing, you know, how is that legitimacy asserted or maintained? I don't want to speak too long because I know everyone else will have lots of questions. A couple other points that spoke to me was that once you get into these processes of land redistribution or land sharing, however flawed they may be, as you rightly point out, it opens up opportunities for new alternatives to be proposed. So in the Peruvian case, the government insisted on a uniform national model of agricultural cooperatives. But in reality, they ended up negotiating a variety of alternatives because indigenous communities in particular said, well, we want the community to have a greater a say in how this cooperative is run and not the state. So I think that's an interesting parallel as well. And two more questions. So you alluded to the fact that people were not vacating lands because they wanted to be working in particular places. So what's the relationship between land sharing and working life? Because in the case of rural land, it's quite obvious that if you're gaining agricultural land, that's also part of your livelihood. But what's the case in the urban context? And secondly, how does land sharing interact with or sit alongside politics for dealing or policies for dealing with the ongoing waves of rural to urban or intra-urban migration? To what extent is this an adaptive policy, or is it rather sort of frozen in time to deal with those that are there already? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, perhaps would you like to kind of respond in a
for a short while, maybe up to 5 minutes?
Okay, thank
and
you.
And then we can kind of open up the entire floor.
Okay, thank you. Well, if I can pick up on first memory, indeed, it wasn't a focus of my research, but actually it resonates very much in Cambodia, I would say, on all sides. So for the people living in these four sites, often you would hear them say, you know, the government policy now is even worse than in the Khmer Rouge time, where we were kicked out of the city en masse for political reasons. Now we're being kicked out of the city en masse for economic reasons. So memory, I think, certainly plays a role, and it comes back. Memory of past atrocities and parallels with what's going on now from the point of view of the land occupants. for the government too, interestingly enough. So these land sharing projects were advertised, were billed as social land concessions, and the government would hark back to even the days of Angkor, the Angkor temples, where there were social land concessions. So these feudal lords would have social land concessions for, it wasn't just the poor, it was allies. It was rural, it was, that was a rural context, well, sort of semi-rural perhaps. And a concession was something an enlightened ruler would do for his, obviously, mostly subjects. And the present government uses that language and that discourse to concede to its subjects in much the same way. So I would argue that memory also plays a role here. And that you asked two questions. One is the relationship between land sharing and working life. I would say the distinction between urban and rural in Cambodia is not easy to make often. I would say that a lot of people are living in the city but have very rural kind of ways of life. And migration is very, very dynamic here. So people don't go forever to the city, but there's a continuous back and forth. And livelihoods play just as important a role, I think, in these urban communities. So that's why land sharing was so significant. A lot of these people living in these sites had livelihoods just around in the area. There were vendors. People on the riverfront were selling peanuts and curries right on the riverfront. So it was very important for them to stay in that area. And then your last question, the rural-urban migrants. So these land sharing projects were, in a way, frozen in time for the people who had already settled there. Land sharing is not a solution, I would say, to deal with rural-urban migration. At least in these projects, it wasn't. But there is no reason why, I think, it cannot be done in a more larger scale. But the point about land sharing is it's often a result of conflict that comes after decades of settlement. So in that sense, it's a bit different. But I don't see a reason why it cannot be replicated on a larger scale. So perhaps I'll end there.
Sure. Can I ask Anna to come to the floor? I can't move this table, stuck to the floor. So. Right, so well, I guess we can just collect maybe two or three questions at one go and let the speakers respond. You can ask questions about anything that came out from Paul's and also Anna's intervention. So.
Student at DPU, UCM. And I'm working on a slum rehabilitation policy in Pune. And what strikes me is that it's very similar to the land sharing model from Cambodia. It's mainly a redevelopment model where private developers are invited to take up the rehabilitation of informal settlements. But what strikes me as a difference between the Cambodian model and Pune's is that in Pune, the government has institutionalized a policy for seeking consent from the slum dwellers for this rehabilitation. So in a way, liberal democratization, so people have. So in that sense, in one aspect, so some of the conundrums, theoretical conundrums that I have had to face is, on the one hand, the citizenship is extended to the slum dwellers. They're not treated as non-citizens. And yet at the same time, that their citizenship as practices, as Paul mentioned, that is something at play, because a lot of these residents have come from rural areas and shifted to urban areas. And I mean, it's always a question in is India how much democratized it is. Has had 70 years of post-colonial experience, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to understand also in comparative mode as to are there similar conundrums in Peru or in Cambodia in terms of citizenship as practice versus as extended from the state to the people, and also about to land sharing.
Okay, maybe another one or two more questions. One here, another one.
Raja Aspanam from DPU UCL as well, and I come from Bangkok. I'd like to ask about the environmental problem that arises from land sharing and to get a sense of how environmental problem evolves in urban poor and how has it been managed? Is it properly managed or insufficiently managed?
One here, and then I guess we let the speakers respond, and then we'll have next round of questions.
I'm Toyal, a research officer at LSE. Thank you very much for a great presentation. I'm actually wondering how do you consider like trust actually matters in especially the case of Cambodia. I guess for you watching the film last night, I saw you smiling, the evolution of white people, and interestingly, there was kind of no resistance against like a massive demolition of the residential block, and I think it's quite related to the trust issue, and like, people were keep worrying whether they will receive compensation as promised by government or not, and I guess this trust or distrust issue is related to the success of this kind of sharing. So I wonder how you find this kind of similar or dissimilar from your case.
If I may, can I also add to Doyoung's question, in addition to trusted dimension, people can still distrust but do not resist because they fear repercussion and oppression. So I guess it's also to do with the nature of the state and the use of the state power. So I think those are three questions already quite big enough. I'm curious to hear what the speakers are going to say. Who wanna have a go first? Who?
Okay. Sorry, Harsh. I didn't quite get your question about citizenship of practice. Could you?
So the government in Pune, the government has institutionalized a policy where the residents of the informal settlements will vote for the rehabilitation.
Okay.
So they would consent only if 70% of the people
mm-hmm.
say yes, the rehabilitation goes ahead. Otherwise, no. So the politics shifts towards, of course, trying to get people's consent. The developer goes and tries to, treat them as clients and, clientelism and so on and so forth. So in a way, citizenship, which is liberal citizenship in the sense of voting for the government, is extended to these people. But at the same time, my question was, in Pune's case, or that's the question for me, but I wanted to understand in comparison to your cases, citizenship as practiced, in the sense of is the idea of citizenship as enmeshed within the liberal democratic frameworks which come from Western theories, how much are they internalized? And in terms of perhaps going back to trust and so on and so forth, as to do people, does voting, for instance, support the idea, support or help legitimize land sharing?
Mm-hmm.
Or would people rather look for other networks, social networks, other social trusts, patronage politics, and so on?
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing from India's perspective, but in Cambodia, with all this heritage or experience of trust issues, for instance, with the state and with the history, is that idea of citizenship, as because you mentioned citizenship as practiced.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to understand what is the extent to which those issues do come up in Peru and Cambodia.
Yeah, so internalization, that's interesting. I would say not much.
Mm-hmm.
Voting, there were lists, so there's a big problem with lists of residents, right? And at some point, all the communities that get to be redeveloped for land sharing, who gets the right to get an apartment and who doesn't?
Mm.
That's a hugely problematic issue. So on paper, there are issues like, okay, one person, one vote in a way, one apartment, you can put it that way. But these rights are traded informally from the very beginning. So this issue of lists becomes hugely problematic, and there was no one there to help mediate this issue. The community organizers, or the community leaders, were corrupt, we can say, and selling these names, right? So
if you're talking about citizenship of practice, you would recognize some aspects of that, like there were meetings where not formally, there was no formal voting, but there was a lot of these processes at work, but I would say very little is internalized in a fashion that would be recognizable in kind of things. Yeah, so that's problematic, very problematic. Now, the issue of trust is a, we can have a conversation about that all day, actually, in the Cambodian context. There's a lot of theories that say after the Civil War, Cambodia, no one trusted each other. They were forced into communes during the Khmer Rouge time, then people came back, and there was such a antipathy to being forced into communes. I think you mentioned a little bit of that in Peruvian context as well. The people didn't want to work together anymore. You hear that, you see that in the literature. And my experience that trust was kind of low in the community. So people did not work well together. Everyone mistrusted the community leaders in most communities. And even in the railway communities where the communities were relatively well organized, that lack of trust was proven to be well-founded at the end, because even those community leaders were had a price. So trust is a very problematic issue. I think the issue of fear. So my framework for analyzing this was Hirschman's exit voice loyalty, and I added a fourth dimension of neglect to see how do people respond to these land sharing schemes. Was it, did most people want to exit, or did they want to voice? Or were they loyal, or did people neglect? And the most common responses were loyalty and neglect, so passive responses. People didn't dare to voice, so there was definitely fear. If you stick your neck out and try to protest, you are cut down. So most people try to resist in sort of passive ways, or hope for the best. And then, your question about the environmental problems, right, land sharing. Well, there were environmental problems to begin with in these informal settlements, where people didn't have services I walked around these settlements before the land sharing projects, and these areas were hugely problematic environmentally, with the lack of services, garbage everywhere, no sanitation, and the question was, can land sharing do something about this? And I think the answer is yes. So when these communities are formalized, these services would be in place to, in principle, to clean up these areas, because people would be getting services. There would be a policy for, I mean, they would then become part of the city, and so the garbage, the solid waste management would then apply to these communities. On the other hand, when I walked around Borregaval last week, you see that the areas between the buildings, you see garbage piling up again, like in the old communities. So that makes me think that there's not much, I don't know if there's much of a policy. Who's in charge, basically? I don't think that has necessarily been resolved by these projects. So officially the buildings are still being controlled by the developer, I think. Maybe Giorgio can correct me if I'm wrong. But I don't see the developer really spending much time trying to make sure these areas are managed well, including environmentally. So I think these 10 buildings, or the 8 buildings that are being built, will become new slums. And we'll see this, many of the same problems, including environmental problems, solid waste and poor services. So that doesn't really answer your question fully, but it's a partial answer.
Would you want to add
I think I just add to the point on citizenship. So the whole model of cooperatives had various sort of elements to promote citizenship. So there was an executive council, an administrative council, and a general assembly in each cooperative. And for many people, this was the first time they got to vote full stop, because there was a literacy restriction on voting. So this is much celebrated as a way of kind of promoting political participation, and there's a lot of study of this in the 70s. There are various problems. So one, the kind of social structure that those cooperatives were implemented on top of. So in many cases, the former managers who had been allied to the landowners were still part of the cooperative, so then they would dominate the discussion and the voting. There are issues of education that might limit participation, and alternative ways of organizing, you know, where an indigenous community might have its own ways of communicating that didn't correspond exactly to a kind of democratic assembly format. And in the 1980s, the majority of these cooperatives then dissolved. And so this has been used to kind of paint a picture of failure. This was a model sort of condemned from the start. But actually, you know, you can see the legacies of these cooperatives in some cases. And one of the interesting things is that there was an emphasis on recording the minutes of the proceedings of the cooperative, and that's something that's been adopted subsequently by communities, agricultural communities. So you can see sort of the sort of slow step in which you can create changes in citizenship.
Before we collect more questions, talking about recording, both to mention this is being recorded for podcast, to make it into podcast later on. So if any of you who already asked the questions and who named yourself, if you don't want that to be included, just let Dr. Lee Major, our center major, know, that so it can be taken, deleted from the podcast. Anyone else who has any concern, by the way, to identify your name, yourself, by giving the name, don't do that. You can just say where you're from, your institution affiliation, so that you have some idea about your background, and nice to see, you know, people from UCM. As well. Also, photographs are for our promotional purpose. Again, you know, our graduate intern for events and communications, Margarita, will be taking lots of pictures, but I'm assuming that only two or three, the very best ones, are going to eventually display on the website. So again, if by any chance you have concern for your face to come out in the picture, do let us know so that we can take that one out of the archives. So next round of question, I see one hand here in the second row, another at the back.
Hi, I'm Giorgio. I'm the third person today that comes from, well, I'm a teaching fellow at DPU, UCM myself, so the third person in the asking questions from UCM. And I'm also a lecturer in the Welsh School of Architecture at Cardiff University. I worked for a while in Phnom Penh, namely between 2012 and 2016, and a good chunk of my PhD research was also on case studies that a few years before were analyzed by Paul. So it was a pleasure to be today here and to meet you in person. The big question that I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if it's of an easy answer, is whether as precondition for a successful land sharing would you still feature the booming land market, the booming housing market, the booming development of the city. Because while working in Phnom Penh, I felt that this booming character is no longer conducive to providing solutions that are actually able to allow the poor to be in the city. And it is not the case that in our collaborations with the Asian Coalition on Housing Rights, some community advantage that you mentioned, when we were organizing field trips with students in Penh and more recently in Myanmar, they are trying to take us toward either very peripheral areas or to secondary cities where somehow the pressure of capital are less strong and where there is still room for maneuver. And at the moment, my last work in Phnom Penh was May 2016, so I'm a little outdated, but I felt increasingly difficult to work there in a proper fashion. Thank you.
Okay, next question.
Yeah, so I'm Rafael. I'm actually a PhD student from Brazil, and I'm here at the Latin American Heritage Center. So thanks so much for the lecture. And I was here wondering whether you had the chance to explore any of the gender aspects of your land sharing or your land regularization programs, like what were the role of women in the negotiation processes, and even like as beneficiaries, if there was any, you know, hierarchy when it comes to the micropolitics of these, you know, side negotiations. And another one is like to pick up a point that Anna mentioned, what's the idea of sharing? What's the outcome of the land sharing experiences that Paul was explaining? Because from the Brazilian experiences of slum upgrading that you might have heard about, it's very difficult to try to do anything different than individual, than any program that the final outcome is different than an individual freehold title. So I was just here wondering, when you say sharing, what's the final outcome of that? What's shared afterwards? Like, what's the concept of sharing? Why you call it land sharing?
Third one.
Hi, I'm Yu Tian from China. I'm from Science and University. Science and University. But that's a problem because you have the land sharing to solve the problem of the slum in the urban region. But that's a problem because just let the separated small slum to together, let the bigger slum. So how please do not solve the problem how the urban poor to live here or how to work for the development. Moreover, maybe this would produce new conflict because the rich and the poor live together. The cost of living of the poor will increase very fast. So this may be a big problem.
If I may also to add to Giorgio, the question. There are seemingly two different temporalities here. One for the developers, the booming property market seems to require a very quick process of building, selling, profit realization, and so on. Whereas participation always comes with very long process of delivery, discussion, negotiation, which are kind of colliding here. So I'm wondering how these two of those assumptions that you talked about, preconditions,
mm-hmm.
which are seemingly not compatible. Yeah.
The referring to participation, you mean?
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah, those two, the temporalities that come with participation and booming property markets seem to be colliding with each other.
Yeah, okay. Wow, lots of good questions. First of all, Giorgio, your point about the booming, I tend to agree. I think now these primate cities in Southeast Asia, at least, not definitely, it's booming so much that you can argue that, I think under the current circumstances, it's very difficult to do anything pro-poor in a city like Phnom Penh. But it depends on institutions. There's a political will, I think it can happen, but I don't see that political will there at the moment. So it's not only a question of the market. The market is a reality, and that market is being fanned by policy. The current scenario seems to be the more the better, the higher the better, the more gold the better, you know, the spectacular. And under those conditions, I don't see the attitude to make pro-poor work, yeah, in a housing kind of context, but in many other contexts as well. So I think you're right, but it's not just the booming real estate, it's also the institutions that matter. Gender, I think it's not something I looked at explicitly, but in my research it came up a lot, I would say. Women were dominant in the communities, in community leadership positions. I think that's not unique, right? That's in many contexts. You see that very clearly in Cambodia, where women were very present in community leadership positions, but also in the protests afterwards, when the land sharing fell apart. It was women that were often on the streets. I mean, who dares to go out and protest? It's difficult in Cambodia to protest. You're really vulnerable.
And the surprising thing is that it was groups of women that would time and again go into the streets and do that. I don't know why, actually, why the women and less the men, but it's an interesting question. And it puts the authorities in a difficult position because it looks bad, right? If you target these often also older women, women with babies, right? From a media, from a public relations point of view, it puts the authorities in a difficult position. But the question of why are women more dominant in these participation, in these community participation process in the first place, and then in the resistance and the protest movements afterwards, it's a good question. I don't know why. But it definitely merits more research and attention, I would say. The idea of sharing, this is also a very interesting question, and you brought it up in the beginning. What is the idea of sharing? I would say in the present Cambodian context, there's very little of it. So these projects were imported from Thailand, and the idea was to replicate them in an environment which is very different. But I think the whole development model now in a country like Cambodia is very much runs counter to sharing. There's very little sharing. There's very little sharing ethic. It's very much everyone for himself, I would argue. So in this sense, land sharing was an aberration. The one project that kind of succeeded was almost an aberration. And we can see that the model, the other three projects were perhaps more set the tone. So the land swap, people opting for a land swap instead of a sharing, I think is kind of symptomatic also of this, the difficulty to share. There's a lot more to that we can discuss. Okay, you mentioned a question about, if I get your question correctly, mixing income groups can be problematic as well, right?
Yeah. Rich and poor living next to each other,
yeah.
Poor living costs going high.
Yeah, this was never a problem in before. In interesting thing about Bangkok, I would argue, is that in previous decades, Bangkok is a city where the rich and poor have, unlike in other cities, really lived together quite a lot. And maybe arguably it's still a city where these income groups are more mixed than in other cities. And it's worked quite well. But what you see now in Bangkok, like in other cities, the development model is now separating these income groups. So you're seeing a more homogenous form of development, with the middle class here and the upper middle class here, the really rich there and the poor, you know, all the way over there. So you're seeing a segregation, whereas before there was a more organic model of development. And that is, I think, a thing of the past under the current development model. So the mixing of income groups doesn't have to be a problem.
Perhaps can I ask Anna to perhaps?
I'll be very brief because I know we've got to vacate the room. On gender, yeah, it was a big issue in the Peruvian land reform because only heads of household could be beneficiaries of the reform and members of the cooperative, so that excluded both women and young men. And that's an issue that is kind of receiving more attention now because although the reform did not set out to help women particularly, women nevertheless mobilized in the space, in the political spaces that were created around issues of land. So again, women were crucial in land occupations, as in claiming land that they wanted to be granted to them. And women would often be the first to occupy the land, followed by the men. I think on the same basis that, you know, it's hard to protect women and children. In terms of sharing, I think that this whole cooperative idea is having something of a resurgence, but on a different basis. So whereas the insistence in the 70s was on the sharing of property, the new kinds of cooperatives are about sharing the negotiation of prices and kind of getting small producers together to increase their power in the market rather than organizing production and the whole business collectively.
Okay, it's interesting how land sharing, when I was listening to it, reminds me of a similar policy tool in South Korea, where they report to the practice as land readjustment, not land sharing, which actually is a quite interesting way of kind of naming it, because land readjustment seems to be more kind of reflecting the power of the state, whereas land sharing is more kind of oriented towards, you know, the experience of the people who are being affected. But I think the outcome seems to be quite similar. Well, not the actual outcome, but the kind of the mechanism itself, the idea itself seems quite similar. So this is not something confined to just one particular part of the region. I think it can be quite wider implication for thinking about. And as you can see, you know, it has some interesting ways of understanding land issues in Southeast Asia as well as in Latin America, in contemporary times as well as in history as well. So